Hi, you're on RN. It's time to walk into some particularly tricky terrain because you are in The Minefield, a program that's all about trying, at the very least, to negotiate the ethical dilemmas of modern life. Your very irresponsible guides for this journey are me, Waleed Ali, and my co-host, Scott Stevens.
Yes, and over the last week, there's been a real struggle for understanding in the wake of the shocking news from South Carolina.
The active shooter, multiple people down.
A Wednesday night Bible study erupts in gunshots.
All units responding, 110 Calhoun Street.
The shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, one of the oldest churches in the South, and once part of the Underground Railroad during slavery. At the scene, 8 are pronounced dead, 6 females, 2 males. Another man dies later in the hospital.
We woke up today, and the heart and soul of South Carolina was broken. And so we have some grieving too. And we've got some pain we have to go through.
That's the South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley speaking there in that CNN report. And one of the words that you did not hear in that CNN report was the word terrorism or terrorist. One of the things you didn't hear was the pledge from leadership to hunt down whoever did this and bring them to justice, and on it goes. Is this different to something that we would automatically recognise as terrorism? I should say that we have, in recent days, seen that conversation about this as an act of terrorism gather some momentum. So I'm not saying that that has completely disappeared. But it wasn't there in the initial response. This was conceived of as something that was very different. And, of course, terrorism is something that's very much in the ether for us now in Australia, with the government now introducing citizenship laws, or laws to strip citizenship from dual citizens who are suspected or involved in terrorism, currently going through the lower house, going through Parliament. And, of course, the Zaki Mallah controversy on Q&A, which we might get to a little bit later. But, Scott, the question, I suppose, that to put first things first that we have to answer is, do we have a working definition of terrorism that we actually apply in a kind of sober way, or is it a term we apply rather promiscuously in political rather than logical terms?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question. This has, I've got to say, Waleed, this has been one of the more interesting aspects of the conversation that many of us have been having over the last week. I mean, why previous incidences of gun violence or racially motivated violence in the U.S. Describing those as acts of domestic terrorism has been conspicuously absent. So I think it's actually, I mean, it's really interesting to me that we are talking in these terms today. Look, you're the expert here. I know what you're doing. You're setting me up for the fall. You want me to sort of wade into the tall grass and lay out some sort of lame definition, then you're going to shoot me down.
No. I'm not doing that at all. I'm just interested in your thoughts, Scott. Go on, please.
Well, okay, let me give you my thoughts such as they are. I do think that it's not so much that we use terrorism a bit too promiscuously today. I mean, we do tend to engage, I think, a bit loosely in categorizing entire groups of people as either terrorists, potential terrorists, ticking time bombs or whatever. But what that demonstrates to me isn't so much that we use terrorism too freely, but it seems to me that most often we're actually working with the wrong term. I don't think that terrorism doesn't mean anything. I don't think it's an ill-defined term. I think it's actually quite a specific term and a term that's it's worthwhile us using and using properly. But it seems to me that what we're really looking at here is terrorism as a species of another modern phenomena, and that modern phenomenon is categorical violence. In other words, a form of violence not against this or that person that I might dislike, this or that group of people in a local community that I might look at with a degree of resentment, but violence against a group of people because that group of people belongs to a certain category, a certain race, a certain religion, a certain ethnicity, or whatever. And it seems to me that if we burrow a little bit further down into that wider phenomenon of categorical violence, that we may well find that so many of the family resemblances that we see in shootings like has taken place in Charleston and also acts of terrorism in other Western countries, I think we see those family resemblances a bit more clearly. So look, I'm not, just to lay my cards on the table, I'm not in favor of massively expanding the definition of terrorist or terrorism to all sorts of acts of public violence. I think we need to be more specific, but I also think that we may well be using the wrong category.
I'm not in favour of expanding the definition of terrorism either. I am in favour of coming up with a definition and then applying it no matter where the chips may fall.
Okay.
And I think there's an important distinction there. So the question of the definition of terrorism, by the way, is one that has been exercising the minds of academics for decades, and they're in heated disagreement about what it actually means. I remember coming across one article that surveyed 55 papers, and in those 55 papers found 72 definitions or something like that. So this is what we are talking about. But if I were to boil it down, and you can critique this if you like, Scott, but if I were to boil it down, I would say the general consensus around terrorism such as it exists is that it is an act of violence or the threat of violence committed by a non-state actor, and there is some argument about that, for a political purpose that seeks to instrumentalise fear or anxiety, and which, of course, implies an audience in some way. That's the definition I would work with. And now it seems to me if you work with that definition, you have no option but to describe what happened in South Carolina as a terrorist attack. What element of that definition does it not fit?
Yeah, look, I actually couldn't agree more. And in fact, the dimension to that that I find particularly telling here is that there is a kind of exhibitionist character. There's a highly symbolic quality about terrorist acts. These are things that are supposed to be viewed, they're supposed to be visible, but it's also on highly symbolic targets that aren't just random, but themselves have a kind of symbolic power or potency that's
Unless the randomness is symbolic. Well, so I think blow up a train station or something like that, that's, you are instilling fear, you're doing it for a political purpose, it's clearly an act of violence. The idea here is that it's sending a political message. I think the way to think about it is that terrorism is really a form of political communication.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be a very violent form of doing that. But it's a kind of language. And if that's the case, then I actually don't think we're in the territory of having a discussion about extending the label of terrorism and the way that it might be applied. I think we're actually in an argument about whether or not we are applying it consistently.
Okay.
And I suspect that's where the response to what happened in South Carolina, I think that's what it's drawing from.
Okay, let me just put one further thing to you then. It's something that, it's probably implicit in what you just said, but it's something, again, that I'm quite interested in. One of the other dimensions I think that we've seen most recently is that oftentimes these very public, shocking, symbolically pregnant acts of public violence, if we can just sort of lay the term terrorism aside for a moment, these acts are designed to do something very, very particular, whether it be things that are perpetrated and then broadcast by Islamic State, or whether it be the shooting in a local church. The purpose of it is to reopen a long festering wound. It's to try to spur or spark deeper conflict, an ongoing war. It's, in other words, if it's something, say, by Islamic State, then it's to try to factor into the very response, the very outrage that will then further marginalize some aspects of the community, that will then further spark forms of discontent and disillusionment that will then further exacerbate the ongoing tension between the two actors here. And that was exactly what Dylann Roof said that he was trying to do. He was trying to reignite. He was trying to re-spark the race war.
Right. And Anders Behring Breivik, same sort of thing
yes.
in Norway. ISIS's methodology on this is abundantly plain. Osama bin Laden and the way he spoke about September 11 and then spoke about the Iraq War and
but is this
how
a more
the Iraq
recent,
War was going to go.
Is this a more recent aspect, though, of the phenomenon of sort of domestic and global terrorism, this kind of this deliberate intent to incite?
Not yes and no. Terrorism is not immediately instrumental in that very rarely is it an act that is done for the sake of its own end. So 9/11 as an example, even though I know that's a recent example, 9/11 was not an act that was designed to achieve the end of killing 3,000 people. It was an act that was designed to make a symbolic statement about an attack on a nation. And perhaps you could argue a civilization. And those 3,000 people were the means. They were kind of the theatre for that to happen. But you go back to the very first act of modern terrorism, as is generally agreed upon in the literature, and what you'll find is the assassination of the Russian Tsar in the 19th century. Now, there's clearly something instrumental about that. But there is also a statement then being made to the broader members of the ruling class. And so I think it is always communicative, and in the seeking a response, that's not definitional about terrorism, but it is strategic, is it not? Because what a terrorist group will always want to do is recruit. And the way you recruit is to radicalize the general terrain. And the way you radicalize the general terrain is provoke an overreaction. It's a classic terrorist strategy that goes back to just about every insurrectionist group that you can possibly think of. And so all the different waves of terrorism that have existed in modern history, and particularly those that have been nationalist independent type movements, that has been a part of the strategy. And indeed, it works. And the IRA managed to provoke the British government to crack down with discriminatory laws. The ranks of the IRA and its level of public support swelled. Now, this is not a new tactic. We've seen it again and again and again. And so the fact that Dylann Roof would do this in South Carolina, I think, is entirely expected. There's nothing unusual about it at all.
So the reason then that we don't apply the term terrorist or terrorism consistently is because it's already begun to accumulate a different, a kind of foreign dimension to it. In other words, it's already become, to some extent in our minds, it's become racialized. It's become bound up with other elements. And look, there was actually something I should say that, in fact, our guest, believe it or not, who I'm not going to introduce yet, she pointed out in a really wonderful article that oftentimes the part of the inconsistency is the way in which these different groups, these different perpetrators of violence are then portrayed. So, for instance, if you have, for example, a terrorist that hails from Saudi Arabia or from Afghanistan or from Pakistan, then they can be often portrayed, even as young men, as sort of ticking time bombs. They are older before they're fully grown. There's already a kind of threatening or menacing quality to it. Whereas what we've seen this last week with Dylann Roof is that we've been assaulted in many ways with images of his childhood. There have been descriptions that he was such an innocent and such a fine young boy. Yes, troubled, but all the same, just a good kid. In other words, there's something about the inconsistency in the descriptions that this can only really apply to one race or to one group of people, whereas in the instance of, say, a white, quote-unquote, terrorist, then this is ultimately an anomaly.
Well, there's certainly truth to that, and I think perhaps the sharp end of that is the way we're beginning to talk about children who've been taken by their parents who have gone to fight with ISIS.
Yes.
And now we're talking about, do they come back? And we're almost having a conversation about them as though they themselves had volunteered as kids. And so all the elements of childhood that would normally pertain are no longer there in that conversation. It's a fascinating development. Anyway, we do have a guest to get to, as you foreshadowed, Scott, and I think we should probably do that. You are listening to The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website, incidentally. Search RN The Minefield, or you can tweet us at RN The Minefield.
Every country has violent, hateful, or mentally unstable people. What's different is not every country is awash with easily accessible guns. And so I refuse to act as if this is the new normal, or to pretend that it's simply sufficient to grieve and that any mention of us doing something to stop it is somehow politicizing the problem.
Yes, that's President Barack Obama speaking this week in the wake of the shooting in South Carolina. This raises a really important issue, it seems to me, and I want to begin by putting it directly to our guest. And so without any further ado, Anthea Butler is Associate Professor of Religion and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. The reason we've got her on the program, quite apart from simply being brilliant, is that she has written one of the most probing, provocative articles in the Washington Post in the wake of this shooting. Anthea, we've just heard that the public conversation in the wake of the shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church has actually moved quite quickly to one of two issues. On the one hand, there's been the public policy debate over gun control, which just seems interminable. And then on the other hand, so much of, say, the social media, a lot of the mainstream reporting now, is getting all up in arms about the continuing symbolism of the Confederate flag flying over capitals across the South. I'm a bit worried, but I wonder if you are. Are these just proxies for a deeper conversation about race relations that we simply cannot have?
I think in some ways, yes. And thank you both for having me on the show today. Yes, this conversation about the Confederate flag vis-a-vis gun control. The interesting part about this, if you think about the pictures you've seen of Dylann Roof in your newspapers, he had a Confederate flag and a gun. And both of those things were together. And both of those together, when African American sees that in the American context, means racialized violence. So it's not a mistake to me at least, to see that if we separate these two conversations and they each take off on a certain tangent, and I will say that the conversation about taking down the flag and resultant taking downs of the flags across the South is going a little bit faster than gun control. It will just get muddied. It will be muddied, and it won't get to the real root of the issue, which is our racial shame in America right now.
Can I ask though, just quickly? I mean, I suppose I'm not so much concerned that that it won't do anything, or that it won't you know, that it actually won't achieve anything. This push to sort of take down the flag. I suppose my concern is, you know, so much today we get so concerned with symbolism, and the media is very good at reporting things that are both symbolically rich, in other words, that are visually striking, but also that give people something to do. Okay, boycott your local Walmart or something. I suppose my concern is, once this has been achieved, or once the flag comes down in various capitals, will there then be a kind of hand-washing? Okay, we've done our bit. This is all that we can achieve now. Let's just kind of go back to the old normal.
No, and I'll tell you why. We've had too much this year with, from Ferguson forward in America, with the different police violence and things of this nature. I don't think there'll be an easy hand wash. I mean, America has almost 400 years of this racial history that is very hard. It's a huge festering wound that cannot close, okay? And we haven't had a national conversation in the way that we should have a national conversation. The moments we have national conversations about race in this country is when a black body dies. And so that's the moment we have conversations in the United States over brown and black bodies. And those are fraught moments, as you well know. So I think that there's not going to be a hand washing this time. I can tell you that I feel that as a historian of all of this sort of race in America, I don't see this going away anytime soon. I also don't see that, unless there's some serious things happening, that we move towards a better arc right now. At least and this will be a very radical thing for your listeners to hear, I don't see us moving past that until after Barack Obama's out of office.
I don't find that radical at all, actually. I find that perfectly intuitive. Because one of the elements of having a black president, I think, is that anything they say on race issues becomes so loaded that it's almost impossible for them to achieve anything, in the same way that Noel Pearson has argued, for example, that Indigenous relations in Australia can only be pushed forward by a Conservative Prime Minister rather than a Labor Prime Minister. But let me take the issue of dirty hands. We have dirty hands now. We're not going to wash them. That seems to be what you're saying. What do we do with those dirty hands? Because it seems to me that is where the issue of definition of violence actually matters. If it's a terrorist act, and if we would approach this as an issue of terrorism, that seems to imply a whole suite of government actions that are completely at odds with the government actions that we do or don't take if it's an issue just of gun violence and perhaps racial politics. So does the definition of the violence make a huge difference here?
Yes, it does. And I think I was listening to your opening, and I want to say something very different to sort of switch this for your thinking to be different. When I talked about terrorism, I'm thinking about a FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States, definition of international terrorism and domestic terrorism. So that, for me, was the measure of why can't we call this person a terrorist? Because if you know anything about American history, you know that black churches are the one place that black people were able to meet, and even at times challenged to meet in churches. The church that this happened in, Emmanuel AME, was burned in 1820 by whites because they didn't want black people meeting there because a slave rebellion had been planned there. So to go into that church, what Dylann Roof did was he knew what he was going to do. And he sat there for an hour, and he listened to the Bible study, and then he shot almost everybody in the Bible study. He killed 9 people. So I listened to what you said about terror, and I thought to myself, if you had lived this history for 400 years of racialized terror, if you had seen Knight Riders coming across a field in the middle of the night, or the KKK burning crosses, or this Confederate flag being flown, and while you were being spit on as you were trying to walk into a high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, that might seem a lot different to you if you lived here vis-a-vis where you are. And I understand all these different kinds of questions about whether it's terrorism or not, but I need to tell you, in the United States, that the Confederate flag and guns have been used in very violent ways, and this was an act of domestic terrorism as far as I'm concerned.
Hmm. Look, if we simply think about terrorism as subjecting an entire category, an entire group of people to an ongoing state of terror, of fear, of sort of both destabilization, but also almost excluding them, keeping them out of the body politic. I couldn't agree more with that sort of more generic definition. But Anthony, even the way that the U.S. uses the term terror, I mean, that already is quite a loaded term that requires a wide-reaching response. I think this is probably what Waleed was going at. It sparks off national debates about needs for de-radicalization.
It means we go to war. I mean, there are all sorts of things that it implies.
Absolutely it does. I think I don't want to discount that, but I think what you saw and what I did in the piece in the Washington Post was also to talk about this issue of, you know, why are Muslims always terrorists? Mm. Every time something happens, you know, you pick up somebody, if they are a devout Muslim and they've done something wrong, they're immediately a terrorist. They can't be anything else but a terrorist. So they're having plans. Now, granted, there are people making plans all the time to go join ISIS or whatever it is. But, you know, and from my perspective, where I sit across from you, I'm thinking that when I see so many numbers, and some numbers came out today in the United States about white men being much higher in America in terms of numbers for domestic for terrorism writ large and hate crimes and things of that nature, vis-a-vis any other group, I have to wonder, you know, why do we always say that the brown people or the black people are the terrorists and the white guy is not the terrorist?
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting the way you yourself have approached this issue. I mean, I approach it through the prism of terrorism because I suppose that's my intellectual training. That's kind of my academic area of interest. You seem to have approached it through the prism of race relations, which is a very, there's a lot to commend that sort of approach. Do you think it matters which way you approach this?
I do. I think it matters, especially in the context. I mean, obviously, you have different kinds of contexts about race in Australia. Here in the United States, we've had these incidences of domestic terror. I'm thinking about the Oklahoma City bombing, where nobody could believe that it was a white Christian man would blow up a government building. But we've had isolated incidences. A few years back, there was a man who flew a plane into the Internal Revenue Service, which is our taxation here in
Joseph
the United
Stack.
States.
I remember this. Yeah. This is incredible.
Yes, remember that?
Yeah.
Into a building in Austin, Texas. Nobody would say he was a terrorist.
And it was after 9/11, the similarities were incredible.
Yeah, it was really incredible. But nobody would call that guy a terrorist either because he was white. So I have to start asking these questions about, you know, what is racialized in this conversation about terror? And in America, unfortunately, 9/11 happened. Every terrorist is a Muslim. Or, you know, there were all the things that happened at the time. I lived on the East Coast in a university city, Princeton. And basically, we had a guy who owned a gas station, and he was a CEO. And, you know, he got taunted because people thought he was a Muslim terrorist. Hmm. It was ridiculous. And they didn't understand the difference between a Sikh and somebody who was Muslim. So this is the kind of thing that just drives me crazy, is that, you know, we tend to lump things and we don't have these kinds of conversations that we're having right now about what that might mean.
To get your perspectives on this and such a obviously well-informed and expert opinion on things that from afar we simply cannot access. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Anthea Butler, an Associate Professor of Religion and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She was, of course, speaking to us via Skype. We have about a minute to go, Scott, and in that minute, I suppose I'd like to ask you where you think we've ended up on this. Does the label of terrorism ultimately matter? Are we applying it consistently, or should we abandon the term altogether?
Look, I think one of the things that I've actually learned quite a lot from this, I should say. I'm probably a little bit more persuaded than I was at the start of the program, which is also a very good thing. Look, I think the issue of consistency is very, very important. I suppose one of my concerns, and it's a lingering concern that I have, is because we have deep concerns, and I certainly have deep moral concerns about the way in which we use, the unnecessarily racist way in which we often use the word terrorism now as something that's kind of cancerous, something that's to be excluded from the foreign, from the body politic, if I can put it that way. I just wasn't sure about the political wisdom of extending that too broadly. But I think, you know, what Anthea has laid out and what you've described, I think, is extremely important, that it's not just a name, but it's also something that necessarily brings a politics and a history along with it.
Yeah, political category of its own,
yeah.
With its own momentum. We are going to have to leave it there. Scott, thank you very much for being my co-host on this journey. You've been listening to The Minefield. And, of course, if you want to get in touch with us, comment on our website or tweet us at RNTheMinefield. We'll speak to you next week.